entertainment, sports, and radio's best guest list. Live from the Zone Radio Studios on Broadway on WZON Z62, WKIT HD3, and at downtownwithrichkimble.com. This is Downtown.
Well, hello there, and a good Sunday morning to you on this third day of June. This is the Best of Downtown, brought to you by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength. Guests of the program come your way on the G&M Family Market phone line. G&M on the corner of Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden. Open every day of the week from 6 a.m. until 9 p.m. I'm Rich Kimble, joined by Carrie Haskell. Our weekly look back at some of our favorite recent conversations. On this week's edition of the show, we'll talk a little bit of history with Joanne Freeman of Yale University. That's coming up in just a moment. We'll talk recent Celtics history, a look back at this memorable year from John Corrales of RedsArmy.com and the Locked On Celtics podcast. And we'll talk about diplomacy with Ambassador Rick Barton, author of a new book entitled Peace Works. All coming up on the Best of Downtown for your Sunday morning. And let's get things rolling with a recent return visit to the program from Yale historian and author Joanne Freeman. Her new book coming out this fall is entitled The Field of Blood, and it's all about the history of violence in Congress. Here's Joanne Freeman on the Best of Downtown. Well, this is an anniversary of sorts. I'm not sure it's one worth celebrating today, but it was 162 years ago today that Preston Brooks clobbered Charles Sumner over the head with a cane in Congress. Certainly the most egregious incident of violence in congressional history, I would assume.
Yeah, well, it was in a sense the most deliberate and thus for that reason even more shocking violent incident because, you know, Brooks came with the cane and sort of walked over to Sumner's desk and very deliberately struck him down. And so, you know, there have been many other things have happened in Congress that are violent, but few of them are kind of that deliberately brutal.
You know, I believe Thomas Hart Benton had a gun pulled on him and pointed on him in the middle of a congressional session. What were some of the other memorable incidents?
Well, there was an incident in the 1840s. Actually, when John Quincy Adams was in the House, and an argument got out of control, and it became kind of a mass brawl, and someone ran onto the floor who wasn't in Congress and shot off a gun, which didn't hit anyone in Congress, but apparently hit a Capitol Police officer in the leg. So that one was a little shocking. I think maybe the most shocking one took place in 1858, and obviously that's getting awfully close to the Civil War. And in that case, people at the time recognized that whereas in the past you had maybe clusters of men fighting or one man fighting another, this was a group of Southerners and a group of Northerners who ended up running at each other in the House of Representatives, and they were armed. So this was people defined it as a battle of North against South. This is a couple of years before the Civil War, but it's kind of striking that in that way Congress is representative, truly, if the people in Congress were literally breaking down to that level of violence and conflict.
Your new book is called The Field of Blood, Violence in Congress and the Road to the Civil War. When did we first begin to see debate spin out of control and into aggressive acts?
Well, there's random aggressive acts that go all the way back to, I mean, maybe the first one I can think of is 1798. I think someone challenged someone to a duel a little before that, but it gets really more violent beginning in the 1830s and then particularly in the 1840s and 1850s. And part of the reason for that is actually the press. When I first started this project and I was looking around in congressmen's papers, I noticed an uptake, you know, sort of an upswing in people punching each other or people worried about what people would think about them. And when I poked around a little bit more, what I discovered is that the press was becoming more efficient. It was becoming more widespread in the 1830s. And so the audience was getting more immediate and bigger. And I think that, you know, if you think about it, if democracy is a conversation between rulers and ruled, if the conversation changes, then the nature of democracy changes. And so I think it was technological changes in part that helped whatever already was brewing as a problem become more violent.
Well, it certainly seems like the polarization is pretty bad today. How does what we're seeing, and not just in Congress, but in the media, in our public conversations, how does it compare to the bad old days of the 1840s and 1850s?
Well, you know, it's interesting. So I think about that a lot, which is not surprising. And I end up being of two minds. So on the one hand, my first book was on the 1790s. So if you look over the really long haul, you can say in the late 1790s, in the 1850s, in the 1960s, and now, all of those moments have been moments of extreme polarization, some degree of violence, growing distrust of national institutions, the press sort of pumping conspiracy theories of various sorts. I mean, there are things that happen in clusters that do not do great favors, probably to any country, but in particularly to the United States. So in that sense, like one of those two minds says, okay, well, we are falling into a pattern that we've fallen into before. But that said, you know, as a historian, I can't say history just repeats, right? History echoes, but it doesn't repeat.
Right.
And so by that, I mean the fact that what we're experiencing now, that we've had echoes of that in the past, is significant and we should learn from that. But it doesn't mean that I necessarily know at all what's going on now or what's going to happen next. You know, we're in some ways in distinct territory now. So, you know, it's, I guess history sort of gives you that kind of perspective and points out to you what's old and what's new.
We're talking with historian Joanne Freeman here on Downtown. It's important to note, too, that while patterns are sometimes the same, the specifics change, and even in regard to our political parties, they've undergone dramatic transformation in the last 150 years, and the parties that we think of as Democratic and Republican today don't reflect the core values they had back in the mid-1800s.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and that's a hard thing, I think, for some people to grab onto, is that because the name is the same, right? So you look in 1855 and you see Democrat versus Republican, and you say, well, we could go all the way back to the late 1850s and see Democrat versus Republican. But the names are the same, but the ideologies and the purposes and the politics and the policies and the context are entirely different. So parties change dramatically over time, and they put together and sort of pull apart things that you would not imagine being together within one party or apart within one party. So, for example, in my early days of being a historian, when I was doing a lot of work that had to do with Alexander Hamilton, right, he's a Federalist. So people at the time said, well, he's a conservative, right? He was a guy who was all about law and order, and he wasn't comfortable with democracy. It's like, yeah, he was a conservative, and he was in favor of big government. So those two things, they don't go together now, right? But they
right.
did in 1795. So you can't draw straight lines from the present to the past as much as people want to. And, of course, they want to because they want to claim a particular political heritage, and people have been doing that since the dawn of the Republic. But as far as it sort of reasonably, you know, realistically reflecting the essence of a party, it doesn't really tell you very much.
Well, you brought up Alexander Hamilton, and you have been researching him, studying him, writing about him since you were back in high school. What was it that made his story compelling to you as a young woman? And if I've got my timeline right, back in the bicentennial year when you first discovered and embraced Alexander Hamilton?
Yeah, it was partly the bicentennial. So, you know, I know a number of historians, early American historians, who their interest was sparked by the bicentennial. So I kind of think maybe some people will be motivated by our current Hamilton mania moment to actually go off and read history and sort of get into history. But as far as I'm concerned, I think the bicentennial got me interested. Actually, I think the movie 1776 got me interested, too. I was about, I don't know, 14 years old or something. And I started reading biographies. And a lot of the biographies I read, I liked. But they, you know, like I read about John Adams, who's fascinating, and but a lot had been written about him. I think I read a book about Richard Henry Lee of Virginia. I read any number of books, and it felt to me as though what needed to be said about those people had been said. And I read, there weren't a lot of biographies of Hamilton, and I read one, and I actually didn't believe it. It didn't make sense to me somehow. Like, I wish I could recreate in my mind whatever the heck it was that made me think that, but somehow Hamilton seemed to me like there was a lot of mystery to him, that people hadn't figured him out, that people hadn't really seemed to have delved into who he was. I went to the library with a book I didn't like, and I said, what did this guy who wrote this book read so that he could write this book? And so the librarian pointed me to the 27 volumes of Hamilton's published papers, and I started reading his letters, and that was that for me. That was, like, to me, the real stuff, right? That was, like, the mainlining history, right? I was like, ooh, like, that's it. There it is. Like, I don't need someone else's book. And, you know, if you read someone's personal letters and private correspondence and public papers for a while, I mean, a long while, you start to understand how that person thinks. And you start to begin to understand, because this person's a politician, their politics as well. So over the decades, I built up a really great understanding of who this guy was and his pluses and minuses and the many ways in which his politics and personality were extreme. But nobody knew who the guy was. So, you know, I would do a lot of public lecturing, and I would tell people, you know, he's a founder, too. You should let him be a founder, too, because, you know, he was in the mix. Now I walk around and I say to people, he's not so great. He's not as great as you think.
Now, when you heard that Lin-Manuel Miranda was working on a musical about Hamilton, you reached out to him. You thought it was important to make sure that Hamilton's words were part of this story.
Well, exactly. So I heard that this was happening. I knew that Ron Chernow's biography was going to be at the core of it. And I logically enough thought, probably there's not going to be a second musical about Alexander Hamilton. So if this is his moment, his own words have to get in it somehow. His own words need to be part of this play. So yeah, I found a way to get a hold of Lin Miranda and hand him an edited volume from the Library of America that I did of Hamilton's writings, and with that message, just put Hamilton's words in the show. You know, put the actual person in the show. So which he did. There's actually direct quotes from a lot of the letters are either directly taken and put in the show or changed very little. And put in the show. So that was gratifying to me that there was, you know, some of the actual Hamiltonian language in there.
I love that you mentioned 1776. We had Bill Daniels on the show a while back, who played John Adams both in the stage production and in the movie version of 1776, and says, despite everything he's done, from being Dustin Hoffman's dad in The Graduate to a number of TV shows, St. Elsewhere and others, it's still John Adams that people talk to him the most about.
Yeah, no, he was amazing as John Adams. I mean, I think when I was a kid, he was kind of a hero because he was so wonderful as John Adams in that film. I didn't get to see the play, but in the movie, for sure. And I think later he played John Quincy Adams.
Yes, he did. That's right.
Yeah, I was going to say, because then he became a double whammy Adams for me. He was like both Adams for me. But that doesn't surprise me. And I think, unfortunately, if he's trying to get out of the Adams shadow, given where we are now, I don't think he's going to do that.
Joanne, talk a little bit, if you can, about the Backstory podcast, which I've just fallen in love with. It's wonderfully entertaining and informative.
Well, thank you. It's wonderfully fun to do. It's four historians, all with different areas of specialization. So I'm an early Americanist. There's Ed Ayers, who is a 19th century historian. And then there's Brian Ballow and Nathan Connolly, who are 20th century historians. And from week to week, we pick some sort of issue that's vaguely connected to what's going on in the news or some event that's happening or a holiday or something, some kind of a trend. And we talk about, appropriately enough, the backstory. You know, we sort of look about how this played out over time. What are the roots of this thing? We find interesting stories that get into the sort of deeper realities of things. And what I love about the podcast particularly is that a lot of it is us sort of bouncing ideas off of each other and talking to each other and learning from each other. So that I just love the process of doing the podcast. And I think the end result, really, you can hear how much we're enjoying doing it. And I think that probably makes it more enjoyable to listen to.
I think you're an absolutely wonderful follow on Twitter. And I saw a comment that you posted, I think it was last week, and maybe was it from Lin-Manuel Miranda, who talked about how you were unsure of what to do on Twitter early on, like so many people. And now you've become a superstar. You're tremendous out there.
Well, I don't know if I'm a superstar, but I definitely am a late adapter of technology, for sure. So I'm the last person. As soon as I pick up on the technology, for sure, the next week it's going to be gone. Right? It'll be like, oh, no one's using that anymore. But I took a workshop a couple of years back, actually this wonderful project called the Op-Ed Project that is aimed at diversifying the kinds of people that do op-eds and speak out in the public sphere. So one of the things they said was, you got to be out in the public, open a Twitter account. And I thought, yeah, okay, sure. So I opened a Twitter account. I can't say I did very much with it for very long. But over the years, I've actually kind of become fond of, and now actually in the last 2 years, I'm beginning to feel as though it's quite important, particularly for historians to find every way that they can possibly find to talk to the public, to link to the public, to talk about American history, to talk about American traditions of governance, to talk about the roots of a lot of things that right now are being questioned or prodded or poked. So, you know, I now kind of, it doesn't go together with a phrase, but I was going to say, I sort of feel sometimes like I have a Twitter mission. You know, like, you know, I need to pump history out in any way I can to the public, and that has become one way. One of the earliest people that I tweeted to happened to be Lin Miranda, because he was one of two people that I knew happened to be on Twitter. And so, yeah, sometime in the last week or two, I happened to be at an event that he happened to be at. And he said, you've got to be quite something there on Twitter. I thought, ooh, he's the king of Twitter. So if he's saying that, then I must have somehow accomplished something.
So before we let you go, these are challenging times here in America. And so using history as a guide, can make us confident that we'll come out of this dark period right now and find that light again, and tell us why the Constitution can survive even the toughest times?
Well, right. I mean, I can't say I know, obviously, what's going to happen. What I can say is the Constitution, as it was created by the framers, was seen as a sort of touch base, like a touchstone, so that no matter how weird things got, you could always find your way back to the Constitution. So, for example, when people were afraid that civil war might break out in the presidential election of 1800 because it was so polarized and people really did or didn't want Thomas Jefferson to be president, in letters afterwards, Jefferson said, well, you know, even if things had gone haywire, the fact is we would have had some kind of a convention or meeting and gone back to the Constitution and fixed things up, and we would be right back with the Constitution. So the idea of putting a Constitution in writing and really putting in writing in a very specific way the framework of government and putting in there, you know, the process so that you can amend it, but still having a basic framework put on paper, the intention was for that to be always a kind of guiding force. Now, what we're learning now is the many, many ways in which norms that are not in the Constitution have been propping that Constitution up. And when some of those norms are violated, it suddenly becomes quite interesting as to what is or isn't constitutional. And that's a lot of what we're talking about these days. So, you know, my thought is, people need to understand the importance of the Constitution and its role and why it's important to think about what it says and not just to cast it aside, because if nothing else, it really was the foundation of this kind of participatory government grounded on public opinion and the American public in a way that governments weren't at that time. You know, it really was a venturing off of what people were doing. It was a world of monarchies. And I feel that people need to remain invested in that idea.
That's author and Yale historian Joanne Freeman here on the Best of Downtown for your Sunday morning. When we return, we look back at a remarkable and unexpectedly good season for the Boston Celtics. John Corrales coming up next here on Z62 Retro Radio.
At Quirk Motor City, you get a huge selection of quality pre-owned vehicles priced to fit any budget. Plus, the Quirk Motor City pre-owned difference, with a limited warranty that's 3 times longer than the average dealer's pre-owned warranty. Free main state inspections for the life of the vehicle. A free Carfax vehicle history report. And Quirk Motor City's certified pre-owned 118-point inspection. It's your quality pre-owned car. Find it at Quirk Motor City in Bangor, Belfast, Augusta, and Portland. View our pre-owned inventory online at quirkauto.com.
Biking season is here, and the only way to be sure that you're road or trail ready is to bring your bike to Slipping Gears Cycling, Bangor's only full-time cycling sales and service experts. At 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor, before prime riding season slips away. Slipping Gears Cycling, 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor, Bangor's best full-service bike shop. Outstanding service, huge stock. Like them on Facebook for updates, shop in person and online at slippinggears.com.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
Welcome to Green Acres Kennel Shop. How many?
Two dogs and a cat, please.
Remember us?
Rex, Sparky, and me, Fiona.
Of course, this way. Your coats are all looking so shiny. Bowl for three.
Ruff!
I'll take a side plate. Dog food's not really my taste.
Rex, try the Nutrisource. Delectable.
Yes, Master Sparky. Green Acres Kennel Shop only wants you to have wholesome, healthy food. So we prefer to work with small, family-owned companies who focus on pet foods.
Any specials this evening, Paul?
Of course, Master Rex. The usual lineup of dog and cat foods from Pure Vita, Natural Planet Health Extension, Signature.
How are they prepared?
Green Acres offers dry food, wet, freeze-dried, even frozen raw food to fulfill your fussy feline fancy. Now, because you all come to Green Acres Kennel Shop so often, your meals are deeply discounted as part of our frequent buyer program.
Wow, sounds like we're the special ones.
Green Acres Kennel Shop, where every pet is special. 1653 Union Street, Bangor, greenacreskennel.com, and on Facebook. Takeout also available.
We love Green Acres Kennel Shop, our home away from home.
At this busy time of year, there's nothing better than a place that offers you one-stop shopping. That place is G&M Family Market on the corner of Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden. Fresh produce delivered daily, a great selection of meats and seafood, beer and wine, of course a Dunkin' Donuts and an Amato's right on site. Stop into G&M Family Market every day of the week from 6 in the morning till 9 o'clock at night, and if they don't have what you're looking for, they'll make every effort to get it next time. G&M Family Market, Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden. Back on the Best of Downtown here on a Sunday morning. Rich Kimble and Kerry Haskell. That was a terrific season for the Boston Celtics. One, they didn't begin that way when they lost new acquisition Gordon Hayward 5 minutes into the season. Then when Kyrie Irving decided he was out for the postseason, it sure seemed like we would be a brief stay in the playoffs, but it was not to be. Celtics with a deep run, making it to Game 7 of the Eastern Conference Final. John Corrales visits with us every Tuesday to talk Celtics. He looked back at this season and ahead to what's a very promising 2018-19 Celtics campaign. Let's look back for a moment at Game 7 for the Celtics, and was it a missed opportunity for them?
Well, it was. Sure, you want to just go from the pure basketball perspective. They had chances, and if they had just hit an average number, even a slightly below average number, and not have as bad a night as they did from three, it might have been a different game. They got away from some things that worked. The Cavaliers got some things that they didn't normally get on the road, and I think the moment was just a little too big for some of these guys. You saw Terry Rozier and Jaylen Brown especially had pretty bad games. And those two guys that had been really, really good at home, especially all playoffs long. So lesson learned. I mean, yeah, they sure could have won that game. Absolutely. You can point to just about everybody out there, aside from maybe Jason Tatum, that they made mistakes. And those are correctable mistakes. And moving forward with hopefully a season where there aren't any major injuries for once, they can learn and build and not make those mistakes in playoffs future.
Having said that, it was a great ride. This was an awfully fun team to watch, and they went a lot further than most of us thought they would go, especially after Kyrie went down.
Yeah, I mean, look, they had how many guys? I forget through the course of the season, they play 100 games and all of the crazy runs that they had. We all remember the 16-game winning streak, but there was that West Coast swing where they didn't have Kyrie and they had a game without Al Horford on top of it, and they swept that West Coast swing, and just time after time after time, 20-point comebacks, coming back against Philly in London, coming back and Marcus Smart drawing two charges against James Harden to come back against the Rockets. I mean, all of these great moments throughout the season. This team was fun, and we said that about last year's team, with Isaiah Thomas having a season, one of the best seasons in NBA history. And then somehow they come out and top it with just a different, it was a different feel. But now you really feel like, as a Celtics fan, you have to understand that and have feel good about all of the things that are going to carry over into the future. The future really seems bright with Tatum. You know Jaylen Brown's going to figure out some things. You know you've got a deep bench now, and you've got two stars. This is a team that was basically one half away from getting to the NBA Finals, and you add two all-star players, two potential all-NBA players to the mix. As fun as the season was, you're especially giddy about what the next season is going to be.
Well, that's right. You look at your two big off-season acquisitions are already guys that are in the fold that you'll be bringing back. So who else is a lock on this roster to be back next year?
Well, I say this with the big caveat that with Danny Ainge, nobody's a lock to be on this roster next year. But I think you're probably going to see everybody come back, with the exception of some guys around the edges. You know, Greg Monroe's gone. Aaron Baines is going to be an interesting guy. Does he come back? Do they make a trade? Terry Rozier is under contract. I think a lot of people think that he's not under contract next year. He is. Next year is the last season of his rookie deal. But he has shown some value, so a guy with that value and that contract might be especially attractive to some teams. So it's possible that they may decide to sell high on him. So I think there's a very good chance he's back, but you never know. And then the big question is Marcus Smart, who's the restricted free agent. He's the biggest name that might not come back. We'll have to see how that plays out.
Well, of course, lots of excitement about next year given this run, but there are no guarantees, and there's still some work to do for this team to get to the next step and make it to the NBA Finals. What's the biggest area they have to work on for next year?
Well, I think next year they have to keep their defense at that high level, because that's what's going to be what wins them games. If you got to say one thing about getting Kyrie back, is that he is their weakest point guard defender. So I think next year there's going to still have to be a focus on that defense. And the biggest thing they have to do, yeah, I hate to boil down to this, but stay healthy. I mean, everybody has to stay healthy, but that's after the past 2 years is my biggest concern. Just, can we get through 82 games where there aren't major injuries? As far as the basketball goes, I want to see what progression Jason Tatum makes. I want to see him get stronger so he can absorb some more punishment and finish at the rim. I want to see Jaylen Brown dribbling a lot more and getting that handle a little tighter. He made some great strides over the course of the season. And then they're just going to have to work next year on how many shots everybody gets. You know, I think when you have Kyrie and Hayward and Tatum and Brown and Horford, I mean, Horford's willing to sacrifice, but those other four guys, they're going to have to figure out how to get everybody an adequate amount of shots, and we'll see what the offensive game plan is for Brad Stevens next year. He came into the past two seasons saying that they need to whip the ball around, and they still average somewhere in the low 80s as far as field goal attempts. I think if they can get that up to 90 in the low 90s and really be up and down, that would be a solution. So figuring out how to get everybody involved next season is going to be a big priority as well.
We're talking with John Corrales here on Downtown. As you look back on the season, John, was there one guy that was the biggest, most pleasant surprise for you this year?
I mean, I have to go with Jason Tatum, I think, because when he was drafted, there were a lot of knocks on him that he couldn't shoot, and there were some questions about his defense. And to come in, especially as wiry as he was, you think, well, he's probably going to get muscled around and he's not going to be able to get to some of the spots that he wants. I remember coming out of summer league, I was thinking he's going to catch the ball very often in a spot where he's comfortable. And because he's so small and, you know, light, that he's going to get pushed out of his comfort zone. He's going to miss a bunch of shots. That just never materialized. And he's been very, very good defensively and picked up the team concepts. You can see him poking even LeBron, stealing the ball from LeBron, knocking it off his leg out of bounds, stuff like that. He's just been amazing. He could have easily been a rookie of the year if Ben Simmons was not considered a rookie. You know, he was in that mix. And I think of those three, he has just as high a ceiling as everybody, which I know he's the third pick overall, and you're supposed to have a pretty high ceiling, but It was a lot higher than we expected, and it came a lot sooner than we expected.
That's John Corrales of RedsArmy.com and the Locked On Celtics podcast. When we come back, a man who's had more than three decades of experience in the diplomatic corps, Ambassador Rick Barton, has a new book called Peace Works. He'll join us next on The Best of Downtown.
When it comes to your health, early detection is the best protection. That's why the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center provides 3D mammography to offer better answers and greater peace of mind, identifying problem areas that a standard mammogram might miss. It provides precise images for all women, including those with dense breast tissue. Call 907-1682 to schedule your 3D mammogram at the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center. 3D, providing peace of mind for you, your family, and your loved ones.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
Angelo's Pizzeria has locations in both Bangor and in Hamden, and they're your home for the best pizza, homemade pasta, and Italian takeout. Angelo's Pizzeria, located on Hammond Street in Bangor and Main Road South in Hamden, features a menu that also includes seafood, sandwiches, wraps, and salads. That means there's sure to be something for every member of the family. Stop into Angelo's Pizzeria, Hammond Street, Bangor, Main Road South in Hamden.
Spring's the time for everything new, fresh, innovative. Time for the brand new, all redesigned Ram 1500 at Hartley's.
The 2019 Ram 1500 is awesome, with more everything, more storage,
more performance,
more technology,
more efficiency,
and more leather.
In the new Ram 1500, there's safety all around you. It's the strongest Ram ever, capable, built to serve,
rugged,
and refined.
Start your own rebellion. Get yourself a Ram 1500 at Hartley's.
Don't miss the 2018 Jeep Wrangler, an all-new version of a true icon at Hartley's.
Diesel power, hybridization, and full-wheel, all-wheel drive are options. Wrangler is legendary for sport, fun, and work. The incredible 2018 is the most accommodating and comfortable Wrangler yet.
The new Ram 1500 and the all-new 2018 design Jeep Wrangler. Check them out at Hartley's.
The best deals on new Ram 1500s and 2019 Jeep Wranglers aren't in the city, they're in the country. Hartley's Country in Newport, hartleyscountry.com.
Thinking of making home improvements to increase efficiency? Well, there's no time like the present. And the people at Penobscot Home Performance want you to know that efficiency main rebates have increased from $700 to $1,000 per zone as of May 1st. Also, anyone with Bangor Gas can get rebates for $2,000 per insulation zone up to $5,000. Call to get your free home energy audit at 469-6100 or visit PenobscotHomePerformance.com.
Penobscot Theater presents
She Was Murdered,
Bangor's premiere of the longest-running play in American theater history.
There's blood everywhere!
A hilarious whodunit set at a hairstyling salon.
Same people don't go around jabbing scissors into other people's throats.
Sheer madness. You spot the clues, question the suspects, and solve the mystery.
Okay, people, time for you to vote.
Sheer madness.
But I don't think any of us did it.
June 14th through July 8th at Bangor's Historic Opera House. Tickets at 942-3333 and PenobscotTheater.org.
I'm innocent, I tell ya.
Back on The Best of Downtown for your Sunday morning.
Nuclear arms in the Middle East. Israel's attacking the Iraqis. The Syrians are mad at the Lebanese.
Some things never change. Talk a little diplomacy this morning. Our next guest on the program has worked in crisis zones around the world, places like Haiti, Iraq, Nigeria, and Turkey. He served as ambassador to the United Nations and the deputy high commissioner for refugees at the UN, and was the first assistant secretary of state for conflict and stabilization operations under President Barack Obama. Rick Barton has a new book entitled Peace Works, America's Unifying Role in a Turbulent World. One of the things you say is that a key to finding peace is for America not to impose our will so much as trust and listen to local people around the world.
Yeah, it's sort of grounded in a practical sense view of how things work in the world. I think all of us are occasionally asked for advice, and sometimes people actually ask for help. But if the person asking for the advice or the help doesn't really want to do something about it themselves, then our rate of effectiveness is extremely low, and it doesn't matter how closely related we are or how fond the friendship is. And it's not any simpler when we go into a country that's in conflict or where people are killing each other. It's, in fact, a lot more complicated. And so we have to be grounded in the same practical, common sense views that we generally approach problem solving in our own worlds. And I try to do that because the world of foreign policy and international relations has oftentimes been taken over by sort of the nuclear physicists or the brain surgeons or the rocket scientists of the social science world, and it's not always to our advantage. We've really got to be much more grounded, and the best way to be grounded is by what local people tell you, and if you listen to them, and then you look for those opportunities, and you can then be a catalytic force rather than just an external problem solver.
How important is humility in the formation and practice of our foreign policy?
I think it's vastly underrated because it is a business. It can be a complicated business. I mean, when we talk about foreign countries, people generally feel a bit disadvantaged because we don't necessarily speak the language. We haven't lived in the country. We don't have many friends there necessarily. So all of those things should breed humility, but I think they oftentimes insecurity oftentimes produces a kind of a braggart approach, and that is really to our disadvantage. When the United States knows the advantageous position we have, but doesn't play that hand, we tend to do an awful lot better because we surprise people with our understated approach, and that's a surprise that works for us.
Well, we have a situation, of course, still developing in regard to North Korea, with the summit postponed at the very least, if not canceled outright this week. And how vital is it in foreign policy to proceed with caution and not predict the outcome before sides actually sit down and meet?
Well, again, human nature doesn't like to be told what you're going to think. I know in my own household, I've been married for 43 years, and if I start off a conversation with my wife by saying, well, I knew what you were going to say before you said it, my chances of having an enjoyable evening have just diminished. So it's these relationships are very similar to others. I think one thing that's missing right now in the North Korean conversation is that the South Korean president is one of the few in the last couple of decades who has been gaining popularity by advancing talks with the North Koreans. And the South Koreans are the local party, our friends, who care about this problem 24/7. As much as we may think this is important, and it is, to future world peace, we're not as engaged, and we don't stand the risk of losing millions of lives if something goes wrong the way the South Koreans are. So I think one advantage of the United States not being in the lead position in these talks is that we can probably give the South Koreans the proper leadership role. And I hope we do not undermine that South Korean president right now.
We're talking with Ambassador Rick Barton here on Downtown. Rick, I thought it was a really interesting section of the book regarding the first senior management retreat that John Kerry held as Secretary of State. And then you say risk tolerance is vital to making peace. Talking about some diplomatic long shots, can you explain that?
Yeah, well, these are the riskiest places on Earth. They matter to us because they can become threats either through disease or terrorism or other things. So they're important to us. But where war is about to break out or has already broken out or where we're trying to tame it, are the riskiest places on Earth. So you can't go in with too timid a profile. You can't say that safety is all it's job one. It is terribly important, but there may be a greater risk than making a Skype call from Kentucky. And if you want your people to build the trust relationships and to be able to advance difficult concepts and to get people to do things that they otherwise wouldn't do, you have to be amongst them. You have to be talking to them. You have to be living with them. And issues like the Benghazi case, where the U.S. ambassador there happened to be the U.S. diplomat who knew Libya better than anybody else in the U.S. State Department, and he was ultimately responsible for the safety of all Americans in the country, and he ended up being the victim. It's not that you want to blame the victim, but he actually was trying to take what he thought were wise and creative risks to advance the peace. And while he was alive, we obviously gained the benefit of that service. But again, it's not that martyrs do not make successful programs either, but you have to understand that these are places where long shots are likely. I had a boss once who said to me, Rick, you're in the venture capital business. And in other words, the likelihood that we were going to succeed every time we went into a place was not that great. But if we did make a place more peaceful every so often, then we had achieved something historic, and we could consider that almost a career achievement. So you have to have a balance between between not being suicidal and not being not advancing martyrdom, but also finding ways to free American ingenuity. And I really believe that we've probably moved too far away from that, holding people, blaming people for almost anything that goes wrong, and not really investing in some of the longer shots that could be big payoffs for us.
And you talk about in the book, too, the impression people have of us around the world. You asked the question at a meeting in Houston, what's the one word? How would the U.S. be seen in the world? And the word that people chose immediately was arrogant. Why is that? And how do we combat that as a nation?
Well, I think there have been places that we've gone in and we've said the locals just can't do it for themselves, so we're going to show them how to do it. And even in some places that we're still working in a developmental state in the United States, we haven't figured it out in the South Bronx. We may not have figured it out in poor rural communities in Maine, and yet we go in as if we have a formula for success. And that's not... again, it's that if you lack that humility, then the other end of the extreme is that you're arrogant, and that is picked up very quickly by people. And almost anybody on Earth recognizes a know-it-all when he sees one, so that is part of it. There's also that very fundamental argument in peace works, which is that you have to know the places much, much, much better than we do. And when I would be briefed by the most skillful intelligence briefers in the U.S. government, I would often ask them, on a scale of 1 to 10, how confident are you in what you know? And the very best ones would say 2 to 3 out of 10, 10 being the high. And that speaks to humility. When somebody walks in and says, I know everything about the Balkan history, these people have been at war for hundreds of years, and there's these natural divisions, you've taken out of play all the intermarriage, the many years that they actually worked together, the very slight differences of language, the oftentimes artificial arguments that people use to create political opportunities. And political opportunities are not always reflective of the way an average citizen thinks, which is, we feel that same alienation oftentimes in our own system in the United States. So I think these are all elements of our arrogance. But at the end of the day, it is about listening to local people, engaging with them, trusting them, and then being there as a coach, as a catalyst, as an advisor, sometimes bringing a little bit of money, but not taking over the place and not running a country as if it's some sort of an American franchise.
You talk about some specific areas of concern in the world. Very interesting to read your thoughts on Afghanistan and Iraq and the lessons that we learned from our experience there. And number one is to clarify the original intent and goals before you immerse the United States.
Yeah, and this is, again, where we really need to involve the U.S. public, because if we keep this stuff looking so exotic, it's so far away, we only call upon you when we need your sons and daughters for a military intervention or when we need more tax dollars, because even if we haven't raised the taxes for these last two big wars that we were involved with, we've spent trillions of dollars. So, but in the case of Afghanistan, there were people who we started with almost two competing ideas. One was that we were going to fight terrorism wherever it went. Wherever it was, and that's what took us into the place. And the other was that we were going to create a kind of model democratic state. And sometimes in the pursuit of fighting terrorism, we made alliances with some very wicked people in Afghanistan, some warlords who would go to the National Bank and they'd take withdrawals when they hadn't made a deposit. You know, things of sort of basic rule of law violations that make it difficult to run a society. And then at the same time, we were expecting that this new government in Afghanistan could build a new army, could professionalize the police force, could start essentially revenue-sharing programs all over the country, improve national health. Many of those things, surprisingly, we have done. And among the successes, health is better than it was in Afghanistan. But those two competing interests were never resolved. And I believe that they needed to be squared up. And it wasn't a question of picking one versus the other. It was determining when one directly undermined the other and making sure that we had an and clause that required our political and military leaders to really understand it. Most of our political and military leaders, we changed them almost every year in Afghanistan, which means we've had about, in the 17 years of the war, we've had almost 17 one-year plans rather than anything greater than that. President Obama tried to reverse that at one time, and now I think there's also a search for that. But fundamentally, we've ended up with that 17 one-year plan problem.
In regard to Syria, you believe that we not only can, but we should deal with Assad in a rational way, and that he'll respond to that.
Yeah, you know, there's some political leaders that you just look at and you say, that person's crazy, and I don't know that I could ever do anything with them. And actually, some of my own experience in Maine politics help me frame that notion that not everybody is rational. In particular, when I was for 3 years back in the late 80s, I was the Democratic state chairman. And of course, I would find people who I thought that we had an agreement or whatever, but it didn't quite hold up. And so you do have that perspective of whether people are rational and you can deal with them. And I do think that the Assads have run a hyper-rational, super oppressive Syrian state for several decades. I wasn't as convinced that Saddam Hussein or Muammar Gaddafi, although they obviously had rational moments, but I think they felt more like teenage boys who suddenly had the keys to the car and could do whatever they wanted, and that was their recreation. So we haven't seen that with Assad, and I felt that if early on we had given him signals that if he initiated certain things, we would respond in certain ways, that we might have reduced the inevitability of this massacre, which has led to nearly 500,000 deaths and half the population of Syria in a homeless state. So, and furthermore, the region. And it's not just about Syria, but obviously the ultimate destabilization for what were close allies in Israel, Turkey, Jordan in particular, but also Lebanon and the neighboring states, who they take the brunt of these wars.
Rick, is the current administration, by pulling out of alliances and being, in a generous fashion, being unpredictable, has that in some way squandered our position in the world, or had that already begun before this?
Well, it's always there are always places in the world where the U.S. standing is shaky, and there are places where things are getting better. George W. Bush's administration, the anti-AIDS program that he started in Africa really led to a resurgence of our standing there. But the danger of the America First idea is that it can be interpreted as America alone, and very few of us think that we are stronger, better, more likely to succeed, solve complicated problems on our own. Loneliness is not a desired state, and the implication has been, of course, everybody is out there to make sure that their own interests are protected. This isn't a Mother Teresa exercise, but the dominant articulation of our position that way suggests that America can do it on its own. And as great a country as we are, if you look at almost any global problem, whether it's nuclear weapons, global climate change, the flight of hundreds of millions of people, these are not problems that are solved by building a wall or finding some other artificial way that has never worked in history, and it's not going to work any better today when people are more sophisticated and they have even more dramatic ways of communicating.
Rick, on a personal level, we touched on at the beginning of the conversation, you worked on the 1972 Senate campaign of Bill Hathaway and so many talented people. Angus King worked on that campaign. How did that shape you and your long career, first in politics, but then in the diplomatic corps?
Well, it's just invaluable. I mean, in 1972, Bill Hathaway was a four-term congressman from the 2nd District, and the Bangor in that area of Maine, the northern part of Maine, and he was running against an icon, Margaret Chase Smith, but he did it in such a positive way. We were instructed to never say anything negative about her, to speak about her as Mrs. Smith or Senator Smith. So when it came time to organize in places like Skowhegan, we had to take a group of, I think you were a junior high school student at that time, and so we had to be as resourceful as possible and find anybody who was willing to do some work, drive them halfway across the state and canvass in Skowhegan and get to meet some other kids, because anybody who was an established adult or political figure didn't want to be seen as part of that. We ended up winning Skowhegan by 300 or 400 votes, and I remember Senator Smith saying that she had loved her whole career but been surprised by the vote in Skowhegan when it came in. But it was really a testimonial to just get great local organizing and a very positive attitude and presenting an alternative vision for that time. And then just really engaging local people and making sure that we were respectful of their attitudes and what they were thinking. So all of that stuff, thank you for all your kind words about the book, and I'm really pleased that you have read it. I'm sure you found many of my beliefs and the foundations of the way that I believe the United States needs to present itself in the world, grounded in the simplest political organizing, which generally starts not too far from Aretha Franklin, and respect and ideas of valuing what people have to say, even if it's the 50th time you've heard it. I mean, these are important ideas, and you've got to really be connected to them and engaged. So all of that is part of it, but I mean, at the heart of all of this is very, very fond memories of going to on a Saturday up to Millinocket with in Andrew McKinnon's family car and with some younger people and leafleting the entire town and having people give us encouragement and giving us a signal that maybe we were doing all right. And so I can feel all of that. It's good to have that, your feet on the ground, and also the closeness of American elections that you don't really know if you're going to win until it's all decided. And that competitiveness also makes you more rigorous and makes you more respectful. So that's a partial answer, but I think, as you suggested, and I hope as you saw, that it's these are among the ideas that I feel are important to the way we do, the way we relate to the rest of the world. And if we make the world more peaceful, how it will enhance America's standing and, of course, our businesses and the safety of our own citizens as well.
I still remember my script. Hello, this is Robert Barnes calling from the Maine Voter Information Survey.
Yeah, that whole survey was a wonderful way to engage a much broader discussion, although the computer technology definitely did not keep up with our work.
Yeah, there's no question about that. Well, Rick, it's wonderful to catch up with you. I really enjoyed the book. Ambassador Rick Barton's book is entitled Peace Works, America's Unifying Role in a Turbulent World. It's not only a good read, but it's an important and a timely read. Thanks so much for visiting with us, Rick. Please give our best to Kit as well.
Hey, Rich, thank you so much. What a pleasure. I'll look forward to seeing you in Bangor or in Booth Bay Harbor or somewhere in Maine soon.
That's Rick Barton discussing his new book, Peace Works, here on the Best of Downtown on a Sunday morning. Thanks to Rick, John Corrales, RedsArmy.com, Yale's Joanne Freeman. So we had a Yale professor and a Princeton instructor on the show this morning. I feel smarter already, Carrie. I don't know about you. And then Corrales, who knows more basketball than anybody.
It was a educational Best of Downtown.
Yes, indeed. And yet hopefully entertaining at the same time. Good stuff coming up this week. By the way, if you haven't listened to this week's edition of Downtown the Podcast, Episode 5, check it out. It's a good one. Author, music journalist Robert Hilburn spent over 100 hours talking with Paul Simon. And that's his new book, Paul Simon, The Life, the first time that Simon has cooperated with a biography. Fascinating conversation. And then an equally interesting turn with Josh Cantor, the longtime organist at Fenway Park. It's all on Downtown the Podcast, available right now on iTunes, Google Play. Download, subscribe, spread the word, tell the neighbors, tell people you don't know, and they'll all of a sudden become your new best friend. Good stuff for us on the show this week. Tomorrow, some baseball talk. Ted Berg of USA Today. Tuesday on the program, Leah Thompson. Now, you know Leah from Back to the Future, Caroline in the City, all kinds of movies, TV shows. She's directing a new film entitled The Year of Spectacular Men. Her daughter is in it, and her husband is the producer. We'll talk with Leah Thompson on Tuesday's program. Also, fantasy baseball expert Al Melchior. The crew from Penobscot Theater will discuss their final production of the season, Sheer Madness. We'll catch up with Carrie Tripp from the Greater Bangor Convention and Visitors Bureau about the Best of the North Festival, which I expect we will be in attendance at because it's got beer, wine, and wings.
What's not to love?
Exactly. I think we'll even give away some passes to that this week as well. And I think at some point this week, we're going down under, Carrie.
Yes.
You ever been to Australia?
I have not.
All right. This, I believe, will be our first guest from Australia on the show. We've been a few places. Terrible. We've been a few places around the world, but never there. But legendary musician, Hall of Famer, Louis Shelton, who played for everybody in the world. He was part of the Wrecking Crew, but also produced a bunch of folks like Seals and Crofts, England Dan, and John Ford Coley. He's played on just about everybody's record. Still going strong and making music in Australia and then coming back to the United States to do gigs as well. He'll join us if we can figure out the time difference. Because even Louis wasn't sure. He's like, it's like 12 or 14 hours. Oh, well, that could make a difference. May not pick up the phone if we're expecting 12 and it's 14, but
Yeah, we'll have to Google that.
Yeah, if we can work that out, we'll find a way to make it happen. This week, big plans for your Sunday?
Lawn work. I got the mowing done, but all the trim work is looking pretty shaggy, so I got to get that done over the weekend. That's my Sunday plans.
That does not sound like fun to me.
It's not. I don't mind the riding mower, but when you have to get out there with the weed whacker and the push mower and get all the stuff that looks awful, yeah, that's no fun.
All right. I'll be on the back porch having a beverage thinking about it.
Thanks.
Enjoy. Thank you for joining us, making us part of your weekend. Thanks to everybody on the program. Catch us tomorrow afternoon, a reasonably live downtown. Starts at 4 here on Z62 Retro Radio. You're gonna be all right now.